Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of February 25th, 2011. The last thing soldiers in theater should have to worry about is their finances, and the best way to avoid that is to leave those worries with someone else.
She went to the bank. She's like, I have my son's overseas. I have his power of attorney. And they let her handle everything. I didn't have to deal with any of the bull.
This hour, we'll look at pre-deployment financial planning. Back stateside, potential homeowners need to do their own planning for a down payment. Programs to help with that can be a blessing and a curse.
If you don't have the resources to save for a down payment at all, you certainly don't have the resources in the event that your roof caves in.
And the authors of Spousonomics return one week later with advice for some lucky listeners.
First and foremost, drown out all that noise. Like, do not listen to anything, except for us, of course.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
What does Tier 1 capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
It is really easy to put off dealing with financial issues around death, wills, powers of attorney, but sometimes you don't have a choice, like when you're about to be shipped off to war. That is the case for 160 Marine reservists in New England who recently went through a financial boot camp of sorts. Officers leaned on them to take care of business before they deploy to Afghanistan later this year. At a time when it's easier than ever for a Marine to have his identity stolen or a sailor to lose her home to foreclosure, the military wants to make sure troops have their affairs in order before they ship out. New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein has our story.
Captain Andrew Lee understands what could happen when he and his infantry unit land in Afghanistan.
I've never done a tour with an infantry unit that we weren't in a gunfight, that we weren't hit with a bomb, that mortars weren't fired at us. Death's real. Dying's real. Dying's, I'm not going to say likely. I'm not going to say it's going to happen. But it is a very real, this isn't for the faint at heart.
This will be Captain Lee's fourth tour since he enlisted more than 15 years ago. The 37-year-old company commander says in theater, a Marine shouldn't be distracted. That said, Lee's dealt with men in Iraq who were seriously absorbed with their mortgages and personal finances.
Hey, sir, I got this. Can I get to a phone? No, stud, you can't get to a phone. I'm sorry, I can't help you right now, but the nearest phone is 10 miles away. I'm sorry you're going through this. I'm sorry that you got that letter. But our little personal problems aren't as important as U.S. operations in theater. Our problems get put on the back burner.
The majority of the 160 troops in Bravo Company's 1st Battalion of the 25th Marine Regiment are young, 18 to 21. Many live at home and have few possessions. Lots of young Marines shrug off the idea that wills and power of attorney directives are even necessary, but not 22-year-old Corporal Joseph DiPietro. 3 years ago, DiPietro found himself stationed in Iraq at Christmas time.
I probably spent about $2,000 on my whole family just getting them everything I've always wanted to get them.
Soon after, DiPietro went to the PX to buy himself some socks.
And when I swiped my card, it said that I didn't have enough money on it. So then I went to the phone center and looked up at my statements. And it was funny because I was like, during the 3 days that I'm outside the wire in Iraq, there was mysteriously credit cards. My credit card was being charged.
And so what did you do?
That was the best thing about the power of attorney. I told my mother, and she was like, all right. She went to the bank. She's like, I have my son's overseas. I have his power of attorney. And they let her handle everything. I didn't have to deal with any of the bull. And it's been fine ever since.
Senior officers in Bravo Company have stressed the Marines can't control what's going to happen to them in Afghanistan. They say it's easy to sit down with a lawyer who's working pro bono and get their affairs in order now. But actually doing it, which evokes images of 21-gun salutes, folded flags, and breathing machines, isn't easy at all. 30-year-old Lance Corporal Luke Wanami lives with his girlfriend. Wanami says Marines have been trained to think they're invincible. Up until now, the danger he'll likely face hasn't really come up at all.
It forces me to stop and think about stuff. Versus if we just kept training, a lot of times when we're just training, you just never get a chance to think about anything, which you almost live in denial.
Wanami sighs. He and his girlfriend have some very difficult conversations ahead.
Now I'm thinking, okay, you know, if I go maimed, for example, as much as she loves me, would she have the tolerance to be with me as somebody who's permanently injured? Is it fair to her that I'm putting her in that position?
Before Corporal DiPietro met with lawyers, he was hanging around with friends he's had since he was 2 years old. DiPietro asked his buddies, Brad and Pat, who wanted his motorcycle and who wanted his paintball gun.
They both wanted both of them, and so they actually did rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Brad got the motorcycle, and Pat got the paintball gun. And it's funny because Brad doesn't know how to ride a motorcycle, and Pat never plays paintball.
But by having that conversation, as light as it may have been, DiPietro says Pat and Brad have a better sense of where their friend is headed. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace Money.
There's a lot of talk these days, not just in Wisconsin, but in states around the country, about the need to tamp down on public employee wages and benefits, part of an effort to close budget deficits. The public policy stakes are, of course, high, but commentator Chris Farrell says the debate carries a message for all of us.
Want to know my takeaway from the escalating turmoil over public employee benefits and contracts? Everybody just has to save more. A lot more. Say at least 20% of your income. Like it or not, it's the only conclusion from the ominous arithmetic of an aging population plus a fraying retirement savings system. All over the country, governors and mayors are in a mudslinging match with public employees. There is a gap between pension assets and the benefits that were promised, which some, like the folks at Pew Research Center, say could total at least $1 trillion. The financial meltdown laid bare what many experts have long known. Too many state and local governments routinely underfunded their pension plans while hiking benefits. Going forward, public plans are going to get a lot less generous, especially for new hires. But we're not just talking government plans here either. Corporate America is facing its own crisis. 3 decades after its launch, the 401k is falling far short of its promise of a safe, secure retirement. Despite strong gains in the stock market, retirement portfolios have been damaged by 2 bear markets and 2 recessions in less than a decade. And if you're thinking, you can always count on Social Security and Medicare, forget it. As Republicans and Democrats battle over how to reduce the federal budget deficit, eventually they'll get to Social Security and Medicare. The programs will be less generous. Add it all up, and it seems that all of us will have to save more for our old age. There are signs that we're on the right savings track. Government statisticians say the personal savings rate was above 5% at the end of last year. In 2005, it was less than 1%. And the Federal Reserve tells us that consumers have reduced their credit card debts by 16% from the 2008 peak. And lots of people manage to do it without a pay raise. But it isn't enough. The new arithmetic of retirement is that we're going to work longer and save more. So, don't wait. Start now.
Chris Farrell is the economics editor for Marketplace. A few years back, we started hearing about a novel new way to pay for college, prepaid tuition. You picked a school, usually a state school, and paid as your kid got older. Presumably, it would save your bank account from some of the outrageous inflation and college costs. But like many a well-laid plan, this one is in trouble. Several states are abandoning the prepaid programs or making big adjustments to them, and parents are wondering what happens next. Jillian Mincer covered this recently for Smart Money Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Talk to us a little bit about why these plans are in such trouble these days.
It's an interesting thing. We have, unfortunately, the perfect storm with the prepaid plans. Just as families really want the certainty of the plans, they're getting more expensive. And the way these prepaid plans work is that someone would put what is generally more than the current tuition into the plan and then have the guarantee that the tuition will be covered X number of years down the road for their child or their grandchild or their niece or nephew. The problem is that as state budgets are facing incredible budget crisis, they are cutting spending to higher education. And as a result, the cost and the tuitions of higher education are soaring. They just don't keep up with the cost of higher education.
So then why does that become a problem? Particularly, you know, why is it a problem right now? So say you have, you know, a 2-year-old and you start putting money into the plan for 16 years down the road. Why in the middle of that would you all of a sudden have a problem?
It's a problem in that some states have committed to coughing up that cash X number of years from now. And a couple of states are actually getting sued over this. The Alabama plan closed a couple of years ago, and it agreed last year to make up for that loss. But then it was sued by families who, after running the numbers and looking at how quickly tuition costs were rising at the state's most popular institutions, that wasn't even going to be enough. Some experts in the field expect that instead of putting the pressure on the plans, they'll start putting the pressure on the universities. And by that, I mean, currently the states have used some estimates of what they think tuition will go up, what they think the markets will do. And of course, that's been lower than we had anticipated a few years ago. Then they've come up with this formula. They expect in the future that instead they're going to make agreements with the universities to accept whatever was earned during that time. And that's what Texas has done. It closed its plan in about 2004, 2005 and reopened another plan. And the state universities have agreed to take those earnings. Of course, the problem with that is if the earnings are way low, then the burden is on the university system.
Right.
And that university system may eventually go back to the state for more funding.
So just to understand the math here, when the parents are making those payments, does that go into some sort of escrow account then, and it's invested?
Typically, you'll pay more than what the tuition rate is now, but you won't pay what the tuition rate is expected to be, say, in 15 or 17 years, depending on your example.
Yeah.
So, for example, right now in Washington State, tuition right now in the state is about $8,500. And for a future year of tuition, families are paying about $11,700.
Hmm. So at this point, would it be fair to predict that these plans are just going to go away and parents of future college students should stay away from them?
I don't think they'll necessarily go away. Many people who are experts in the field anticipate that more of the plans will look like the Texas plan. Parents will pay in now, and the state universities will accept the tuition that the plans have earned at that point. They're still a really good tool for families to save in. The thing that families really need to look at is whether the state guarantees the plan as it does in many states.
Jillian Mincer is a senior investing reporter for Smart Money, and we've been talking about prepaid college plans. Jillian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
For some tips on making college more affordable, go to the Making Money blog at marketplace.org, where Lynn O'Shaughnessy of CBS MarketWatch reviews 4 common myths about financial aid.
Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. So we move now from the whole paying for college conundrum to the, oh no, where will I go conundrum, and what a minefield that can be. Just ask Andrew Ferguson. He's a senior editor at the Weekly Standard and author of the new book, Crazy You. That's the letter U. And as for the crazy, well, he's here to tell us all about that. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, you begin your journey into the world of college admissions innocently enough when a few college brochures started finding their way to the mailbox, but they quickly multiplied to, what, more than 100?
Oh, easily, yeah. I think we were averaging, I think, about 100 for a couple of months.
Good Lord. Well, as you point out throughout the book, this is an entire industry now, and a big part of that is the folks who say that they're experts in getting kids into college, these private counselors. You met with one of the supposed top dogs. Describe for us what that was like.
I heard about her from a friend of mine who said, you have to come see this woman. If you're starting to worry about your kid getting into the right kind of college, but there's one catch, it'll cost you $40,000. I, of course, don't have $40,000, but I pretended I was going to write an article about her, which I ended up doing. When I went with Kat Cohen, who was the college counselor that we were talking about, to a group of what they call high net worth individuals, which is a sort of the new word for rich people.
Mm-hmm.
She went in and told them what they were going to have to do to get their kids into Brown or Dartmouth or, be still my heart, Harvard or Stanford. These people, she had them scared to death by the end of it. And in fact, I think it sort of started to feel to them like it was almost an impossible goal. And of course, this is the big myth about college admissions now, which is somehow the exact school that you want to go to is going to determine your future and your future happiness, when it's actually quite clear, and there are studies about this, that where you went to college doesn't have any influence on your future happiness or even your job earnings, for that matter.
So having been through that process, both as a reporter and as a dad, do you think it's worth it at all to hire a college counselor?
Well, it started to dawn on me as I did more research. There were two things that we know are true about colleges. Kids go there and they don't learn that much. And as I say, it doesn't have a lot to do with their future happiness. So why doesn't the industry collapse if people understand this sort of commonsensical thing? And what it is, I looked in the mirror and it was me. It was parents like me who, even though our head tells us that this isn't really the way things ought to be, our heart keeps leading us towards it, because the thing feeds off the very normal desires of parents to see their kids have a happy life. And that's the thing, that's the fuel that really keeps this whole thing going.
So these days, parents have websites to research. They have brochures coming from the colleges. They have rankings to figure out. I wonder, having been through the process, do you think that that wealth of information hinders rather than helps?
Well, I became quite convinced about halfway through the acronym TMI for too much information.
There's right.
Also such a thing as TMA for too much advice. As a parent, you are just surrounded by these guides and the websites. You can go on College Confidential, which is the largest of these things. And one of my bits of advice that I do give parents is stay away from College Confidential, because it's the place where I realized the iron law of college admissions. For every piece of plausible advice you get, you will find within a week equally plausible, directly opposite advice. Everything cancels each other out, and you don't know which one to pick. You know, if you're on College Confidential or any of the other websites, and somebody tells you, you really should get your college counselor a bouquet when he writes your recommendation, the advice comes from somebody called Puppy Whuppy. How are you supposed to gauge how serious this guy is, And then, of course, somebody says, never buy a boutonniere for your college counselor. And this is sort of Love Savage 79. And so who do I think is smarter, Puppy Whuppy or Love Savage 79?
Well, we won't give away the end completely, but there is a happy ending.
Yes, there is.
So what was it like
getting the
prized acceptance letter?
Well, that was the high point. My son had kind of settled on the big state university, which I call BSU for reasons that become obvious. Actually, there's a mortifying passage quite at the beginning of our journey, which involved going to his college counselor at his high school. And the counselor said, we have to figure out what kind of school you want to go to, big, small. And finally, my son said, look, what I want to do is go to a school where I can take my shirt off, paint my chest in the school colors, and major in beer. And sure enough, that's what he got.
Yeah. So what are you left with as a parent? If you could have done something different, something better, what would you have done?
Well, it's so easy to say this. If I had a dime for every time somebody told me to relax, I could, I could actually afford tuition at a college. But that is the best advice. The stakes aren't as high. Your kid will probably get into school. He or she will probably have a fulfilling experience. If everybody would just kind of calm down and let the kids be kids, I think we'd all be better off.
Andrew Ferguson is the author of Crazy You, that's the letter U, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College. Thanks a lot. It's been awfully fun.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Andrew's book hits the shelves, or, Kindles, this coming week. You can read an excerpt at marketplace.org/thebigbook. Every week we take on your money issues, and here to do that with me this week is Kathy Kristoff, contributing editor at Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Tess.
I have found that a lot of people are starting again to pay attention to what's happening with the stock market. A week ago, we had the Dow and the S&P 500 hitting, 2-year highs. We had the NASDAQ looking at its biggest high since 2007. All of a sudden, people are thinking, I got to get back in. So
right.
Here we are again. Buy high, sell low. I mean, did we learn nothing?
Well, yes. the problem is if you watch the market on a day-to-day basis, you are always either going to be euphoric or depressed,
right?
Because it's always doing this crazy back and forth. If you watched it for the first couple of months of the year, we're just soaring, you know, nothing but up, everything's good news, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in the last couple of days, it's crashing. But really, if you just not looked at the market for like the past 5 years, nothing's really happened. Nothing's really happened. I mean, it's just like we keep on telling people, don't look on a day-to-day basis because it will just make you crazy and possibly make you do something that you'll regret. And the real trick to doing well is to find some device that will make you a little less emotional about this decision.
Mm-hmm.
Remind yourself, what is this money for? And if it's for something long-term, you treat it like it's for something long-term. Just keep that in mind. And when it's volatile, go, oh, yeah, that's just how that is. I'm not going to look.
Stock market.
Oh, exactly, exactly. Treat it like your crazy aunt, you know?
All right, I can do that. Well, with that out of the way, shall we leave Wall Street and head to Cincinnati? Erin is with us. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
What do you do there in Cincinnati?
I am an admin at Children's Hospital.
Oh, wonderful. So you work around kids.
Actually, I work around mice and scientists in the research area.
I don't know that I would want to work around mice ever, unless there was a cat around, too.
They're all in cages.
Okay. And what do you do when you're not around the mice?
I volunteer at the local theater, and I'm applying to grad school right now, so it's taking up a lot of time.
So are you calling about student loans for grad school?
Not directly. I'm actually calling because I did my undergrad at a very small college.
Mm-hmm.
It only had like 1,000 students. And
wow.
Even so, there was another person there with my same first and last name. She was a couple years ahead of me. But for the first year or so that I was in school, they kept sending her mail to my P.O. box. I didn't really think much of it. A lot of the mail was from credit collection agencies.
So this is an evil twin.
Yeah, I guess. A doppelganger. And I didn't think anything of it because it was just the wrong P.O. box, so I just threw it away. And then in January of 2006, my mom called me panicking because some credit agency had called her and said, you know, we need to talk to your daughter. She owes us $20,000.
Oh. Wow. And mom goes, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm. No, she was like, Erin, someone stole your identity. She totally trusted me. So way to go, mom.
Yeah, exactly.
When that happened, I was still in college, and I didn't have a credit card. And I had taken out student loans, but I wasn't paying on them. So when I called the credit bureaus, they informed me that I didn't have a credit history. And mm-hmm. So I would just get these calls from credit agencies, and I would, you know, we'd work out that they were looking for a different person, and they'd leave me alone. And a couple months later, another would call. And this just went on until I graduated in 08. Then I went to apply for an apartment and was rejected because her information had become linked to my credit history.
Oh, geez. Oh, this is a nightmare, Kathy.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is a common nightmare. If you have a common name, you are often mistaken for somebody else. And it's even worse because they had the same name and they went to the same school.
And 4 months ago, another one of her credit cards turned up on my credit report. So I just constantly have to keep an eye out for this.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kathy, I mean, she's done everything right so far. Is there any way to just take one hammer and fix all this?
No. Unfortunately, what the problem is that this same credit collection account will get sold. The new buyer now will start over again in trying to collect, and sometimes they'll start over again in trying to put this on your credit report and all that other stuff. What I would do is add a letter or a statement to your credit report, which you are legally allowed to do, saying that there is another person with your name who has bad credit and that it's a consistent recurring problem, you know, something along those lines. And for you specifically, I never recommend credit monitoring services, but for you, I would, because of exactly this.
Do I need to add this statement to all three credit bureaus? Do I need to call the three separate bureaus and add it at each one?
You can do it online.
Yeah.
And yes, you need to do it for all three.
Yeah. Okay.
Good luck, Erin.
Thank you so much.
A tough one. I'm sorry we didn't have better news for you, but just keep at it. And, you know, I mean, it's one of those things, write your congressman. Right, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau?
I certainly will.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Erin.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, and next we have Catherine right here in Los Angeles. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Tess.
So, of course, you know, as a listener to the show, that every time we get someone from Los Angeles, I have to ask, are you an actor?
Well, I toyed with it, but no, not anymore.
Then what do you do?
I tutor. I go to people's homes and tutor kids.
Oh, wonderful. In what kind of subject?
Oh, all the subjects, math and science and English and history and Spanish.
Wow, so. Good for you. That makes you an all-around really smart person.
Well, smart enough for high school students anyway.
Absolutely. And are you from here originally? Most of us here in Los Angeles are migrants one sort or another.
I'm originally from Alaska. I've moved around a bit, but originally from Alaska.
Alaska. What was that like?
It was a great place to be a kid. My parents built a log cabin in the southern coast of Alaska near
Valdez. An actual log cabin?
Yes. Yep. Okay. They built it with their friends, and we lived there. So I have a very rich memories of, you know, salmon fishing and building snow forts and cross-country skiing and climbing trees. And
so did you walk around with an axe slung over your shoulder?
We did actually, you know, learn how to split wood when we were pretty little, but we trained the dog to get firewood from the shed when we'd send him out. So we could
How did he do that?
He must have been a big dog. You don't do that with a purse dog.
No, you know?
Well, how can we help you out today?
Well, my husband and I, we've been renting half a duplex, and it's an old house that needs a lot of repairs, but the owner is considering selling it.
Hmm.
Assuming the owner does decide to sell and we can agree on a price that we both think is fair, can we do this without involving real estate agents? Because my understanding is the biggest part of their job is matching up a buyer with a seller, and it kills me to think of paying all that commission money, but I don't want to get into something that's over my head, so wondering.
At the risk of offending the National Association of Realtors, yes, you certainly can do it on your own, but Kathy, you would want to have probably a lawyer looking at your paperwork at the very least?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big transaction, so you want to do something to ensure that you're doing it right. I would also recommend Nolo Press has a book, Buying California Real Estate, and there's a section in there about doing it without a realtor.
Oh.
The big risk here is if you don't structure your contract right and something goes wrong in the transaction, and then, of course, you put your deposit at risk or you could be sued for, you know, breach of contract. Those are the things you need to worry about, but there's nothing that legally
forces you to use a real estate agent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it is a lot. I mean, it's 6% of the transaction amount.
Right.
And so typically what happens is if you buy without a realtor, the seller will reduce the sales price by, you know, what they would otherwise have to pay the realtor.
Mm-hmm.
So, it can be a really great deal.
Okay, that's great.
So does that help you out, Catherine?
Yes, it's great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Good luck with the buying and selling.
Thank you.
And finally, we have Anna, and she is in Nevada City. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Cass. How are you?
Very well. And this is Nevada City, California.
Yeah, weird, right?
Not Nevada, right?
Not Nevada. Up near Tahoe.
Are you a skier?
No, I'm a terrible skier. I'm more of a sledder.
So you're not much of an athlete then, is that it?
No, I am. I play volleyball.
Oh.
I have a question related to volleyball, actually. I just started coaching. It was a volunteer assistant coaching position. But at the end of the season, they gifted me $300. And I didn't feel like I wanted to spend that money. I wanted to maybe try to turn it into a scholarship or invest it in some kind of way that it would grow and then I could give it back to the program. And I was wondering if you guys had any advice on how to do that.
How lovely.
Yeah, this is really great. Well, it depends on what your goals are. What do you want to do with this?
It's a good question. I haven't totally thought it through yet. So that's why I just want to tuck it away from now and see what the opportunities are.
Anna, what have you done up to this point in terms of your philanthropic life?
I give to NPR every year. And
yay!
The Humane Society and little things, little chunks of money. I'm still young, so I don't have like loads of money, but I try to give back to the organizations that matter most to me.
Well, Kathy, what do you think? I mean, this is a decent chunk of change, $300.
It is.
And it sounds like she's wanting to keep adding to that so that she can do something more significant down the line.
Right. The challenge, though, is if you're trying to invest it in something that has a better than CD-like return.
Yeah, good luck with that.
It's extremely difficult. Really, for the moment, there isn't much to do with this except for keep it in some sort of a bank account. Then, you know, on a related note, if you open this up to getting other people to donate, you know, I'm trying to do a scholarship fund. Tell other parents who are involved in the volleyball program, you know, if you wanted to donate to this, what we're going to do is just at the end of each year, give it to some deserving student.
Anna, have you thought about asking other people to contribute to your effort?
I haven't, but it is a great idea.
Yeah, are you on Facebook?
I am.
Yeah, so I mean I get requests like that all the time from friends who are just looking for a few extra bucks to donate to a cause.
If you're part of a program, you know, you can just talk to
the people who are in the program.
Yeah. You talk to the people who administer the program. Do you already have something like this? They might.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Well, good for you. I mean, boy, talk about giving back.
Oh, thank you guys for the help. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Good luck.
Thank you. Take care.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can find us, of course, online at the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff of Kiplinger's Personal Finance, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. And now for a follow-up to last week's conversation with Paula Schumann and Jenny Anderson, co-authors of a helpful and hilarious new book about money and marriage. It's called Spousonomics. And if you remember, they agreed to do some Spousonomics counseling with one lucky couple, and they rejoin us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Thanks for having us.
Well, we had a lot of folks write in, and joining us now are Emily and Phil Strong from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Before we get into your question, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourselves, how long you've been married, any kids in the picture?
Well, Phil and I have been married for about a year and a half now, and we met on Match.com, and we are expecting our first baby in September.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you guys talk about money before you got married?
Oh, what do you think, Phil?
That sounds like a no.
We both come from very different views of money and how it works. And so I'm kind of a control freak when it comes to that. And so he's probably actually better at it, but I just feel more comfortable being in charge of it.
Phil, why don't you tell us why you're with us this week?
Emily was a big fan of the segment that she heard about the book, and, you know, we figured we could get some good insight in a really, you know, interesting and fun manner to our upcoming child and all mm-hmm. of the issues that are coming up with it.
And Emily, any specifics that you want Paula and Jenny to address?
Well, I think the portion that I really hit home with me was the part about the marriage that's too big to fail, like the Lehman Brothers of marriage. And I kind of feel like that's our marriage. Like, we've just been so great together for the last 4 years. And, you know, we've been married for a little over a year and a half, and that's been fantastic. And I'm kind of wondering what this new addition is going to do to our lives.
Well, Paula and Jenny, you actually address this very specifically in the book, The Arrival of a Child and What That Means for perhaps Division of Labor. One of you want to take a first crack?
This is Jenny. I think one of the most important things you'll need to do is almost create a market, so to speak, for the value of what's going to become a huge number of intangibles. So if you guys at this point have sort of worked out your division of labor at home, or you have some kind of system, it's about to be sort of blown
rocked.
Up. And what happens when a baby comes is a sort of new system takes over, but you don't talk about it. And I think that's what's very frustrating. I think because you're home with the baby and Phil isn't, you become more of an expert in what the baby needs. And I think you sort of have to create a value for that and then figure out what Phil can become an expert in and where his comparative advantage vis-a-vis the baby can be.
So Phil, how would you describe your division of labor currently, pre-baby?
Oh, wow, she's laughing. Apparently she can't wait to hear this answer. Emily has certain things that she likes done in a specific manner, and those things I stay out of her way on. But other than that, you know, dishes, vacuuming, I try to help out as much as I can. I know I don't do nearly as much as she does around the house, but, you know, anything she needs, she always knows she can ask.
Is there anything that you specialize in?
Vacuuming, obviously, snow removal from the house and the roof. She's actually very handy, so, you know, any of the installation of, you know, light fixtures or anything like that, she is, you know, more than capable of doing that. So I would say she definitely does more around the house than I do.
So, Emily, have you guys talked about how that might change?
You know, we haven't. And I think, you know, you get a lot of advice from people who are close to you and who know you. And I think that kind of skews it because I'm just kind of like, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I want some real meaty advice. But Phil cuts himself short. He actually does a lot more than that because when I am messing with the electricity, he has to stand guard with the phone in hand just in case I need to call 911. Because there has been a time when I've been kind of tossed across the room messing with some outlets, but that's a story for another time.
Paula, how far down the road of kind of practical do you go with this? I mean, do you draw up a list of who's going to do what when the baby comes?
I would say, I mean, and you could just experiment, right? Like, there's this great concept in economics called Pareto efficiency, which basically is a situation where if one person can be made better off without the other person being made worse off, then it's not yet efficient. So if you find a situation where one of you, say Emily, can be made, or whoever it is, can be made better off, and Phil will not be negatively impacted by that, then you should do that, because then you're not in an efficient situation yet. And it's kind of a nice way to think about, what can I do for the other person that actually will be no skin off my back?
So are we going to get this videotaped so I can keep replaying this over and over again? That's a mantra.
Yeah, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 in the morning when you'll be up feeding the baby.
Well, I also want to say one thing. Emily, you said something which I think is really important, which is, you know, people keep giving you advice. There's this idea, and, you know, in finance, of market noise, which is all the noise of the market that affects your decisions about things. Like, rather than basing your decisions to buy or sell a stock, you do it based on what people are telling you. You're not looking at the information and what's important to you and how good the company is. So I would say, you know, first and foremost, drown out all that noise. Like, do not listen to anything. Except for us, of course. Don't listen to anything anybody. Jenny's looking at me.
I was going to say, when you have a baby, when you don't know what you're doing, you are looking for some advice.
Right.
But figure out the people you trust and ask them for their advice, and then drown out all the others who sort of offer it unsolicited.
So, Emily and Phil, I think you've got a little legal insider trading going on there.
Awesome.
Okay.
It's worth it.
All right. Thanks, Emily and Phil.
Thank you
for having us.
And thanks, Jenny and Paula, for the free advice.
Thanks for having us.
Financial journalists and co-authors Paula Schumann and Jenny Anderson. We had such a hard time choosing just one winner from all the creative entries, so we chose two. Stephanie Knight and Chris Gahn of Boise, Idaho, got our attention with poetry.
He was listening to Marketplace Money when he heard a story quite funny on Spousonomics, you see, and so intrigued was he played the podcast for his honey.
I love it. And there's more. You can hear their full Spousonomics session at marketplace.org/money. The nation's housing market can't seem to decide if it's recovering or faltering yet again. Prices are falling, which would seem to be an opportunity for buyers, but sales of new homes dropped more than 12% last month. Part of that blame can go to the fact that you have to have a lot of money on hand to get a mortgage, 20%, sometimes more. There are down payment assistance programs available through nonprofits and some state agencies. But Marketplace's David Gurrow reports from the nation's capital, the jury is still out on whether those programs are for good or ill.
Adriana Siriano lives in Northwest Washington. She's proud of her home with its big windows and natural light, hardwood floors, and granite countertops.
This building was rehabbed into a new building, so everything is brand new, which is great. So I'm the first occupant here in the apartment.
Siriano bought this one-bedroom condo in 2009 for $230,000. Just over 500 square feet, filled with plants and family photos, it's her first home. She rented for years, and for a long time, Siriano didn't think she could afford to buy her own place. She makes less than $50,000 a year, working as a case manager for a mental health agency. But then a friend told her about a D.C.-based housing nonprofit where she could get her down payment. It's a loan she doesn't have to start paying back for 5 years, and it's interest-free.
The day that I went to go sign the settlement papers, I handed them a $35,000 check.
She combined that with savings and money from her parents to put $55,000 down.
Down payment is clearly the single biggest barrier to access for underserved families.
David Stevens heads the Federal Housing Agency. It insures billions of dollars of home loans made by lenders it approves to first-time home buyers. Those include mortgage loans and backing for down payments.
Put it very simply, if you have a steady job and you make a paycheck, but you're a lower income or middle class or lower middle class worker, you don't have a lot of excess disposable income to save up for a down payment. So you're locked into a rental cycle that you can never break out of.
Richard Green teaches real estate at the University of Southern California. I asked him if down payment assistance is risky. Does it indicate that people might not be able to afford the mortgage in the first place? Green says it's a real concern.
If you don't have the resources to save for a down payment at all, you certainly don't have the resources in the event that your roof caves in. The truth is, personally, I think people do need to put some sort of down payment on a house. I think it's important to assure their success in the long term.
Yannicka Ratcliffe is a researcher at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Over the last decade, she and her colleagues have followed 50,000 low-income homeowners.
Within the study sample that we follow, there is no difference in default rates between households who got some kind of down payment assistance and those who didn't. They both have performed quite well.
What does seem to make a difference is when homebuyers take the time to learn about all the costs and responsibilities of buying a home to decide whether it's really right for them. Many down payment assistance programs require counseling and classes. There's homework. Applicants have to make a budget and follow it. Roberto Curcia worked with Yannicka Ratcliffe on the study. He says people who go through these programs get a broad perspective on what's involved in buying a home, and they're less likely to get into trouble as a result.
Receiving pre-purchase counseling makes the default intervention more effective. So if a family gets into trouble and unable to pay the mortgage, they are more likely to talk to a lender. They're more likely to resolve that in a way that works for all parties.
Richard Green at USC still advises wannabe homebuyers to put some skin in the game. He says they should try to save for 6 months, maybe a year. And if they can do that, they've demonstrated something important. They may be asking others for help, but they're capable of helping themselves. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace Money.
And before we leave the housing market, loyal listeners will remember we recently traveled to San Diego to visit the home of Karen Andreen. She and her husband were struggling through a maze of mortgage modification red tape.
No documents were signed. All we have is a sheet of paper basically saying, this is your trial payment. So every month we're paying $400 less. And so every month then we're assessed late fees.
And that's because you had a trial modification.
Correct.
Well, we have some developments on that story. Karen, welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
So it's been about a month since we visited you. What's happened since then?
Well, since then, we received a call from a new negotiator. Her name was Melissa. And when she had called us on February 4th, she said that she'd get back to us on Monday at the latest. And we didn't hear back from her until this past Friday on February 18th.
And I believe that's after our producer contacted Bank of America and said, hey, what's going on?
Right, yeah, he'd contacted them, and I'd been in contact with your producer. And, you know, and when we didn't hear back from her, we assumed that we weren't getting the loan modified, and we started making foreclosure arrangements. My husband has a couple job opportunities elsewhere, and our condo was keeping us in San Diego.
Yeah. But eventually, the bank did give you an offer?
Yes. They got back to us. The loan modification was for 40 years at 4.5%.
Which sounds pretty good.
But we unfortunately had to decline it. I mean, they waited so long to get back to us. We started making foreclosure arrangements.
So you're talking about making foreclosure arrangements. Are you actually doing that formally, or are you walking away from the property?
We have been in contact with an attorney talking to them about, it's called deed in lieu foreclosure. I know mm-hmm. very little about it. But we've started talking about that. We talked about a short sale, but where we live, that's just not feasible for us.
Right.
We looked at the terms of the 40-year loan, and unfortunately, you know, we have a family of four, and our condo is 850 square feet, and it would take us 22 years to make back any type of equity in our place. You know, that's just, you know, not something that's also feasible for us. So,
right. Do you think at this point that you would ever venture back into the housing market?
Not for a long time. We're not very impressed with how it went this time, so we'll have to see in the future, I guess, how it goes.
Well, Karen Andreen, thanks again for speaking with us, and best of luck to you and your family.
Thank you.
And a spokeswoman for Bank of America, by the way, told us she was, quote, totally embarrassed at the bank's lack of timely follow-through. So when we're not busy offering advice on what to do with your money, we have been known to enjoy a movie or two. So in honor of Sunday's Oscars, we asked a few of the nation's top critics for their nominations for Best Money-Themed Picture.
My name is Ignaty Vishnevetsky. I'm a film critic for Mubi.com. I also co-host Ebert Presents at the Movies. Most movies are kind of about money, but if I had to name my favorite, it would have to be If I Had a Million from 1932. A billionaire tycoon thinks he's about to die, and his whole family is there, and all they want is their inheritance, and he thinks they're a bunch of greedy vultures. So he says, you know, I'm better off just giving my fortune away to random people from the phone book, and which is what he does.
Now, would you mind telling me now that you have that money, what you're going to do with it? Oh, not that you have to, but it's yours, my sweet. You must use it to gratify your every whim.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin from Reels Channel, Maltin on Movies, and LeonardMaltin.com. I think my favorite movie about money is a classic story that's been filmed many times, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Being a traditionalist, I go with what many people consider the definitive Christmas Carol from 1951, the British movie starring Alastair Sim. Scrooge, of course, is a man who is completely miserly, yet derives no pleasure from his money. He cannot begin to comprehend how Bob Cratchit, his lowly, underpaid employee, does have a happy family life.
It's the family more than me, sir. They put their hearts into Christmas, as it were, sir.
Yes, and put their hands into my pocket, as it were, sir. I suppose you better have the whole day, but be back all the earlier next morning.
I will indeed, sir. Thank you, sir. It's more than generous of you, sir.
Yes, I know it is. You don't have to tell me.
Hi, this is Betsy Sharkey. I'm a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. And my favorite movie about money has to be Chinatown. It's all about conspiracy and about people and love and power, but ultimately it is about money.
And that's what you were going to do in the Valley.
It's what I am doing. The bond issue passes Tuesday. There'll be $8 million to build an aqueduct and reservoir. I'm doing it.
Going to be a lot of irate citizens when they find out that they're paying for water that they're not going to get.
Oh, that's all taken care of.
Hello, my name is Omar Moore, and I'm the founder and editor of the Popcorn Reel Movie Review website. My favorite movie is Glengarry Glen Ross. The film is a story about four salesmen in Brooklyn, New York, who try to stay afloat by selling real estate. The most enticing scene of all from this one is Alec Baldwin's tour de force sequence. His speech defines the whole film and the era.
A, B, C. A, always, B, B, C, closing. Always be closing. Always be closing. You close or you hit the bricks.
Well, we hit the bricks. No, actually, we hit Facebook and Twitter to get your picks. Among them, Other People's Money, A Simple Plan, Trading Places, Brewster's Millions, The Big Lebowski, Wall Street, the original one, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and from my friends at Only a Game, The Brinks Job. I have to add that one to my Netflix list. Go to our Facebook page and give us your picks. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. While we're on the subject of social media, it has certainly changed the way we interact with friends. The boss may be next.
A lot of companies like Facebook are placing the CEO out in the middle of the floor with everybody else. I think that's definitely the death of the corner office.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins, Stephen Hoffman, and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.